What exactly is a business paradigm, and how is it useful? It helps you to design your business model by providing a new understanding of what an entrepreneurial business must do to be successful. Per Bylund explains via the concept of facilitation of value.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast. Entrepreneurs are economic heroes. They improve others' lives with preferred products and services, innovation, and value. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one by building a beautiful business. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hey, Hunter Hastings here. Every week on this podcast, we try to provide business tools and methods that, together, when matched to the right business task and implemented to solve the appropriate business problem, can contribute to a better business performance. Our tools and methods are inspired by Austrian economics, which gives us our design guidelines, translating sound theory into best practice. At a higher level, there's something we could call an Austrian business paradigm, a new way of thinking about entrepreneurial business, its purpose and its core concepts. Is this distinctive and quite new paradigm any use to you? We think it will be. We believe that you can apply it as a framework at every point in your business journey to help you solve problems from developing a sharper business model to more focused product development and more effective marketing and sales. Let me give an example. In a discussion with a CEO recently, we were trying to dissect the problem of a growth rate that was below target. We discussed sales and marketing and product features and benefits. We discussed how much performance improvement the product could create for the customer. But we ascertained that our sales and marketing departments did not know in intimate detail how exactly potential customers appraised the value that they could create by using the product. Was it convenient enough and easy enough to use for their specific staff with their individual level of experience and sophistication? Because they're the ones who are actually going to create value with the product. What role did their own self-perception play in making a decision about the product? To help understand the potential for new users, it's necessary to develop an empathic diagnosis of how current users feel about the usage experience. Such data won't come from unit sales or revenue streams, but from deep understanding of the feelings involved. It comes from intimacy, being there with the individual users in the midst of solving a problem or tackling a difficulty. All of this adds up to a clarifying and enabling insight. Firms and product development teams don't create value. Customers do. How customers use, in what context, via which users, against which problems, these are the constraints. And ultimately, how do they feel about the experience? Here's the terminology we use to capture this insight: facilitation of value, not creation of value. No value is created by shipping the product and turning it on. The producer is merely facilitating the circumstances in which it is possible that the customer will have a valuable experience. It's the customers who create value, each in their unique, idiosyncratic, and perhaps imperfect way. Facilitation of value is a subject into which we're going to dive deeply today with Per Bylund, Twitter's favorite economist, a returning guest, and more importantly, professor of economics and entrepreneurship at Oklahoma State University, and the author of several books explaining Austrian economic theory, including The Problem of Production and The Seen, The Unseen, and The Unrealized. Per, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Thanks for having me again, Hunter.
Well, you're always very welcome. And we've talked in the past about the facilitation of value, and we're going to expand on that today and talk about how important a concept that is. In fact, you believe that facilitation of value is the purpose of the firm. It's an Austrian way of saying that entrepreneurs and their firms can't create value. And that's the standard language of the business school and Wall Street analysts and books that you read and so on. The economic task is not to create, but to facilitate value, which is creating the circumstances in which it's most likely for value to emerge from customer behavior and for customers to have a value experience, which means that customers create value. Again, I may not have this exactly right, so there's a lot to unpack. Let us start with the definition of value. When we say value, what are we talking about?
Sure. So value is really a subjective sort of feeling. It's the satisfaction of a want, we call it. What that means is really that it's you feel better off in some sense on your own terms. So it's something that you gain from using something. So a simple example would be you're feeling hunger and therefore you eat and that satisfies that feeling. So no, you're no longer hungry. So it takes you from where you are to something that you expect to be a better state. And that sort of transition or that journey between those two states on your own terms, in your own mind, is betterment, it's improvement, and that is value.
And when the business schools talk about shareholder value or stakeholder value, and startup entrepreneurs have to think about creating value for their investors, is that a different kind of value, or is it just the wrong use of the word value?
Well, I would say it's probably both, in the sense that they talk about value in terms of dollars and cents. And that's a simplification. It's sort of an approximation of intersubjective value. It's a way of putting a number to it, but it's not value itself, because the value is a feeling. So it's something that you can't really measure. It's something that you can't really compare between two people. And you, only you as an individual can compare two different outcomes and how valuable they are to you. So you can sort of rank them, but you can't really say that you like an apple 2.54 times as much as you like an orange, for instance. You can say that you like apples more than oranges, but not a whole lot more than that. And then, of course, when you buy something, you spend dollars and cents that you have earned and have some emotional attachment to, probably, but you also recognize that you can get different things for those dollars, and you will choose those things that that you buy based off of the value that you expect to get from the goods.
Well, let's stick with our definition of value as subjective, as you've described. And I think another step in the logic is that the customer or the consumer is active in the value experience. It doesn't just happen to them. They're free to change their preferences and change their behavior as their context changes and their circumstances change. They can just change their mind. So they're active in this value experience, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they are the ones determining the value that they get. And since it is completely on their own terms, they make an estimate, or they expect how much value they will get from this, or I shouldn't say how much, because you can't really put numbers to it and make calculations and things like that. But you're acting to satisfy a certain want that you have, and you're trying to do that in the best possible way on your own terms. And no one else can really help you to gain that satisfaction. That's completely internal to you. It's in your own mind and your own feelings. So what you can do is only provide them with the means that they believe is sufficient to take them to this better place.
And that takes us to the idea of value uncertainty. I think I've heard you use that term, that the entrepreneur faces value uncertainty because they can't be sure that they're creating the right circumstances, as you just described. But also the consumer or the customer is a bit uncertain as to whether an offering will create value for them. So this uncertainty is two-sided. Did I get that right?
Yes, absolutely. So the consumer, and this is something that we do not often talk about, at least not outside of the Austrian School of Economics, that the consumer, we often change our minds and we see something else that we would rather have gotten after the fact. So whenever we buy something, we do not really rank the values that we will get from the things, but instead we rank our expectations of value. And that could be simply remembering that, oh, donuts taste really great, but now I've been on this diet for a very long time, and you buy a donut expecting it to give you this sense of satisfaction. But then when you get the donut and you have it in your hand and you start eating it, you're not feeling as satisfied as you thought you would. And that's an uncertainty that you, as the consumer, have to bear. And you are the one losing out on the satisfaction that you anticipated. So even consumers learn how to satisfy the wants that they have through different products. And they learn which products are better and in what sense they can satisfy your wants and so forth. So there's definitely an uncertainty also for the consumer, even though since it is internal to us and it happens only within our minds from choosing to get a product to using it and whatever we feel from using it, it's something that is not stressed a whole lot. And I'm not even sure that psychologists talk about this a whole lot. Instead, they probably talk about measured satisfactions before and after the purchase and things like that. But there's definitely a potential problem for consumers that when they estimate to get a certain satisfaction out of something, but it simply doesn't happen. And of course, if they choose to buy a product that they very urgently want at a certain point in time, they can very easily, as soon as they buy it, see something else that they want a whole lot more. And we see this in children, for instance, when you can offer, say, two siblings candy and you ask them to choose, and the first sibling chooses one kind and the other chooses another, and then they want to switch. The first one says, no, I want what he has. Well, they just experience this consumer uncertainty in the sense that, well, wait a minute, this other person chose something else. They might know something about how to satisfy their wants using this other candy. So obviously I might have made a mistake, so I want that instead.
We are discussing with Professor Byland a more human way to think about business. It's not solely about dollars and cents, or machines and code, or products and services. Rather, it's putting people in first position and improving their lives. We've captured this paradigm for you in our online course, The Austrian Entrepreneur's Journey. It demonstrates how to put people in first position and how to realize value as a result. It's available at e4epod.com/journey. That's the letter E, the number 4, the letter E, pod.com/journey. And now back to Dr. Byland.
Another example I've seen used for the digital age, the donut for the digital age, if you like, is a PC that might be manufactured and assembled by some firm. It includes certain chips and certain software and certain screen technologies. And if that's bought and used by a gamer or an accountant or a physicist, they're all going to get different experiences of value out of it. They may not get the experience they thought they were going to have. The chip might not be as fast for the gamer, and it might not run the equations for the physicist, and they might download the wrong software. So even in this sophisticated age, there's that value uncertainty. You never know what you're going to feel.
Yes, and it's even worse than that. I mean, in this case, they want different types of sort of observable objective uses for the computer, but you can have different gamers interested in playing the same game, and they have different expectations and they value different outcomes. So for one gamer, it could be a certain resolution is necessary, and for another gamer, it's not as necessary. So the same computer giving them exactly the same output is valued differently.
So the word that I like to use for this situation is that value is emergent, using that word in complex system theory, that you can't predict it. You might be able to orchestrate the circumstances for it to occur. It's going to occur in this interaction between the entrepreneur and the customer, but you don't know exactly how. Is emergent the right word?
Yeah, I think you can use it that way, because it's sort of a learning process through consumption that the consumer will figure out whether the estimate of value was actually correct. So you learn in consuming that one good, or you learn over time in consuming different types of goods, and thereby you create these anticipations or expectations of value from other things. So the value experience and sort of the matching between products, goods that you can see and that you can touch and that you can buy, and the value you actually get from them, that's something that changes throughout our lives, and that we're learning practically every day what will be a better way of satisfying our wants.
Yeah, you used a term there, Per, about the accuracy of the predicted value or the expected value. Is it ever 100% accurate, or is it always changing, always a moving target, always subjectively different?
That's a good question. I think it's pretty much always not 100%. Mm-hmm. But I mean, since value also is not measurable, I'm not sure we can say exactly what 100% is. I mean, you can ask people after the fact, was this to your liking? Was this what you thought it would be? And they would say, yeah, it was pretty much, or I've had this type of pizza from Domino's 5 days a week over the past 2 years, so I know what to expect. So it was very, very close. But is it 100%? I don't think we can tell. And it doesn't really matter either. I mean, what matters is that the consumer is sufficiently satisfied to do it again or to learn from it and do something differently next time.
Well, let's see if we can move further now in this paradigm that you're putting forth about the facilitation of value. So let's use that term emergence. The expression in systems theory is that it's constrained by the context of the customer. They have their own goals and hopes and desires and aspirations and previous experience. And an entrepreneur with an offering has to fit into that context. And that's the reason why you can't create value. You can only facilitate it as best you can. Is that the right step to think about the customer's context all the time?
Yes, absolutely. And it's very often when I talk about value as being subjective, people tend to respond with thinking that it means it's completely random and there's no way you can predict or foresee at all what's going to happen and you have no clue. And that's sort of a philosophically speaking, you don't know exactly, of course, but there are many ways that you can figure out close enough that you're going to satisfy a people's wants with a good. And close enough comes simply from knowing people in general and recognizing that consumers are people just like you, meaning they probably feel things similarly, similar to how you feel things. And of course, the simple fact that you're not catering to one consumer. So you're not trying to fit your product or your good 100% to this one consumer. You're trying to expand and sort of broaden the scope so that you can get more people interested and thereby sell to many people. So you want a product that is saleable in the market. You don't want a product that is tailor-made to simply one customer. No one else wants anything like it. So it's not, I mean, it's in a sense, it's a quantitative thing because you want to cater to a whole segment, say. But the reason that you can cater to this segment and these customers as a group is that you understand them on a personal level as people who lead certain lives or have certain characteristics that you think are important, but you can place yourself in their shoes and thereby figure out, would this be valuable to them or not? And how valuable would it be? Not in terms of numbers, but is it really, really high on their value scale, or is it not very high at all? And that matters, of course, when designing the product and making it available.
Yeah, one of the techniques I like to use there is what I call one perfect customer. So that's the marketing equivalent of methodological individualism, if you like. If I can define and really get to know one perfect customer and meet their needs, tailor to their idiosyncrasies, then I can expand that into a segment or a persona or a group of people. It may not be identical, but if they're close to the one perfect customer, then I can scale my business.
Yeah, and you can and you can know this because people are people. So there is a limitation to people are not completely random, even though sometimes it seems like people are a little random, but they are similar in many, many respects. And there's path dependency in interactions and so forth. So it's not completely random. It's not completely open-ended. It's just not perfectly known.
So I think that brings us to another one of the great insights of Austrian economics, which we Austrians have known for a long time, but we don't communicated very well, and that's the concept of consumer sovereignty. The consumer has the primary position in the business model. They decide what is successful by buying and not buying. And I do think that's different than the standard business rhetoric of customer orientation or customer centricity. I think that tends to be tactical about collecting data from the customer. It's not the same as consumer sovereignty. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree. And I think every entrepreneur who has a little experience knows this too, that you can survey customers, well, forever. And even though you have super responses and you have statistically significant outcomes and everything like that, you still don't know if you are going to be able to place a sale when you finally have the product ready. So it doesn't matter how many times you ask people or how much you study people, because they might still choose something differently. And that is exactly the consumer sovereignty thing, that consumers decide whether they will buy something and what they will buy in that moment. So they might have a plan for what they want to buy, and they might have views of what they should buy or something like that they will probably tell you if you have focus groups or surveys and things like that. But the thing is that they might change their minds very quickly because someone told them something, or because they saw someone else use something, or because they just they're in a different mood today, or whatever it might be. And of course, consumers are choosing between different ways of spending their money and satisfying themselves. And all it takes to make a consumer choose differently is to have a different offering. So even if you asked them yesterday that whether they would buy something from you at a certain price, and they said, yes, I would buy 100 of them. And today you show up at their doorstep with 100 items, they might say, no, I would not want any of these anymore because I bought something else. Or today I've thought about it a little bit and I changed my mind, or no, I woke up this morning and I had a backache, and so I'm going somewhere else and I'm not interested in this anymore. Anything could have happened. And that is why the customer or the consumer is sovereign, because they are always making the decision of whether to buy or not and what to buy. So they can tell you that they really want something, but it's in real life, that doesn't really matter. It's the sale that counts, nothing else.
And that brings me to think in terms of a value for entrepreneurs and for firms that I think of as humility. I'm not sure that's exactly the right term, but it's this search to fit in to the customer's life, to their aspirations, to their values. And as you say, to their changing circumstances and feelings from day to day. We tend to call that meeting needs, but it's far more complex than that, I believe. It's a great guide for entrepreneurs to follow. It reduces uncertainty if you get it right. But boy, you have to be pretty humble in making sure that you're following all those changes in the consumer's life. You can't direct them. You have to glean these things from them.
Absolutely. You also have to know people. You have to really be empathic and know how they lead their lives. You need to know what might speak to them and what language to use too. Because what you're selling is not the product itself, it's the whole experience, like we talked about before on this podcast, that the way you're offering something, the situation in which you're offering something, the timing of how you offer it, the language you use, the words you use, all of this matter too. And And it depends, of course, on the consumer's situation, whether that consumer is willing to accept the message, is willing to consider the product and everything like that. So you really need to figure out and understand people in general in order to place a sale.
And the tool that entrepreneurs use to do that is what we call empathy, empathic diagnosis, trying to get inside the consumer's head, understand their context, and become a good fit into their lives. I maintain that empathy is a trainable skill. You can work at it and get better. A lot of people disagree on that. What's your take on empathy as a skill?
Well, I think it's definitely something that you can learn over time. You can learn by studying people, by interacting with people, by simply being open to that people have different viewpoints and values and things like that that might differ from your own. So very often we try to judge people using our own framework of values and so forth, but we need to recognize that people are different in different ways and have different views and different aims as well. And in order to be empathic with your customer, you have to figure that out, and you have to respect the customer for who they are, because they are making the decision to buy or not, and they are the ones to evaluate the offering that you have, which means that you have to place the offering in as attractive terms as possible for the customer from their point of view. So unless you understand the customer very well and knows what makes them tick, then you can't really do it. So I think you can definitely learn it through experience. You can probably study it. Some people tend to be more empathic than others to begin with, but it also depends on what consumers you're aiming to please. Because some people, they don't want entrepreneurs who are very empathic or emotional or feelings first type of people. They want someone who just gives you the product and nothing else. So it really depends on what you're offering, to whom you're offering it. And knowing this, you can figure out how to best please the customer on the customer's own terms.
That's very humanistic, which I think is a big value that Austrian economics brings to business. It sounds a lot different than big data, which isn't humanistic at all. But is the data useful? Is that data collection, can I analyze it in a humanistic kind of a way? Or are empathy and big data in an entirely different fields?
Well, they're different things, but I would say that big data can be used to just figure out relationships and figure out limitations, really, of what you can accomplish. But I wouldn't rely on, I wouldn't rely on big data to make decisions, because data is always historic. Anything that has been measured and put in a database, even if it's almost instantaneous, is based off of decisions that were already made. Whereas what you're doing as an entrepreneur is always trying to please customers in the future. So when you place the sale, it's already done. Your job is really to make sure that you actually sell. And that the customer, of course, then is satisfied with the purchase and wants to come back and buy again, perhaps, or something like that. But you're always aiming to please customers in the future and not the past. So big data, I mean, to the extent that people don't change their minds a whole lot, and to the extent that they do not get completely different products that they like a whole lot more between when it was recorded and when you are going to make your offering, they can sort of narrow it down. But as an entrepreneur, I think your job is also to exceed the customer's expectations and offer them something that they, when they go, wow, I never thought of this before. This is fantastic. I really need this, which really changes the situation for all other entrepreneurs. So you're disrupting that customer's situation by offering them a lot more value than they expected, meaning other entrepreneurs and their offerings are disrupted. Which of course means that if they relied on historic data to make these offerings, and there you are disrupting it, then the big data meant nothing at all. And the more entrepreneurs there are, the more disruptions there will be, meaning the less you can rely on actual data because things change.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4EPod. That's MISES.org/E4EPod, and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
And the picture I like to paint for that connection that you painted between getting empathy and design right, and then the customer spends money and you the entrepreneur, get a revenue flow. I think of that as the customer rewarding the entrepreneur with their expenditures, and those become the inbound income flows for the business, and that's how you measure success. Is that the transition from subjective to marketplace behavior, the measurement of the inbound income flows?
Yes, absolutely. And I think we talked about that a number of times on this podcast before, that the job of the entrepreneur is really first to figure out whether their offering is really valuable to the consumer. And that in turn determines what price the consumer is willing to pay. And you want as much difference between the two as possible, meaning that the consumer will profit in a sense. So the price is not really determined by you, even though you might pick the number to put it on the price tag, but the real price is determined by the consumer. Your job as an entrepreneur is to make sure that the cost of production, the cost of getting the whole experience to the consumer, is below the price that you can charge for that product. And the difference, of course, is your profit or your loss. So it's the transition happens really in choosing the costs so that you can get the price that the customer is willing to pay. And of course, the more value you offer the customer, the higher price they're willing to pay. And the more customers are willing to pay the price as well, because you're offering more value than everybody else. So the transition from subjective value, the satisfaction felt by the consumer, to objective prices and the profit for the entrepreneur is really in the action of buying something. When the consumer expects to profit from it, because this is the best they can do with the money they have in terms of satisfying their wants. And that's the reward for the entrepreneur, because if they place the sale, that means the consumer estimates or expects that good to be the best possible satisfaction that they can get, given all the alternatives and all the other products that they can buy. And then, of course, the entrepreneur needs to keep the costs below that in order to get something for themselves.
Yeah, and that's a calculation. I want to make one more connection here, Per, to something you've taught us before, but I want to make sure we make the connection that once the entrepreneur has established this inbound business flow, the revenue flow that's coming from consumer purchases, they can appraise or calculate which of their resources or which of their assets are, let me say, most associated with the revenue generation, with the inbound flows, and they can make the necessary adjustments to strengthen this relationship when consumers change and they need to recombine their assets, as we like to say. That sounds really, really difficult. So help us with how entrepreneurs might do that in the real world, and then link it to your facilitation thesis. Are we still facilitating value when we're combining and recombining assets to generate inbound flows? Is that the same thing?
Yeah, that is what we're doing. We're trying to satisfy consumers in the best way possible. Of course, in appraising the value of a resource, I mean, that's a way of figuring out how that resource can be used, if it's used in the best possible way compared to other resources that you already have, and combine them in different ways, or maybe sell it and buy something else, depending on the market value, the market price that you can get for it. it's really a way for the entrepreneur to figure out how to do things in a better way. And what they are doing is, of course, facilitating value. None of it would be worth anything at all unless consumers actually consider the output of value and chooses to buy it for a certain amount of dollars and cents. So it's still facilitation of value. The problem for the entrepreneur is to figure out these resources available to me, either inside the firm or resources that they can acquire in the market. How can I get as much value as possible out of this for the consumer first, which then determines a high selling price, which then makes these resources affordable to the entrepreneur.
So that takes us on a full loop from understanding value as the consumer or the customer defines it and experiences it subjectively to the design of the firm and its assets and its resources in response. I have to think that this is a, if we put it all together right there, it's a new business paradigm. Not sure that's the right word. Again, we've got to get our wording right, but it's a new way of looking at business. It's not stakeholder value and shareholder value, which we mentioned at the beginning, and it's not any of the other popular business paradigms. Facilitation of value, where the customer takes the primary role, the business takes the customer's point of view, the customer determines value, the business tries to fit into that determination, they use empathy, and they measure success of their empathy through establishing those claims to income, those future flows from the consumer over time. They've earned it. They've been rewarded by the customer. That seems, if we can assemble all of that for our entrepreneurs listening, as an approach to business, a paradigm for business that is different and useful and can be a key to success for a lot of entrepreneurs. Is that valid to think like that?
Yes, I think so. And I mean, we have to remember that the economy is for people and by people. It doesn't make any sense to not put people first then. And of course, the whole point of having production at all in just general terms is to satisfy more wants for more people. And that's the role of the entrepreneur, to figure out how to satisfy more people in better ways than has already been done, or in new places where no one has been satisfying these wants before. And it's really all about people. It's about understanding the consumer and just placing yourself in the consumer's shoes, figuring out how you can make their lives better, because that's how they will choose to part with their money. If you can make their lives better than anybody else, they will choose your products. And then they will be willing to pay a price that is high enough to cover your costs. So it's really a humane way of seeing the economy, I would say. The economy is this way. It's just that, unfortunately, we tend to think about it in terms of dollars and cents and in terms of products and machines and things like that. And those are simply just means to an end. The end is to serve people and make people's lives better. And entrepreneurs are sort of the heroes in this whole system, figuring out the best ways of doing that through facilitating the value for consumers, to providing them with the means to make their lives better or as good as possible. So, I mean, there's really no limit to what is possible in the system if we just recognize that it is for people, by people, and that it is based on the fact that you serve yourself by serving others. It's by providing others with the means to satisfy their wants that I can get paid and thereby satisfy my own wants. So, I mean, there are no contradictions, and it's all about people serving other people and thereby serving themselves. I think, to me, it's a beautiful system. It's something that gets lost or overlooked very often in both business schools and in economics today, unfortunately.
Well, we've used the term building beautiful businesses, and I think that follows from what you just said, which obviously I endorse and we'd love to communicate. Another term that you've used, and I think is important is there's an ethic there that this service of others, Adam Smith called it self-interest, but it's not really that. It's as you said, if I help you make a better life or make your life better, then I too will be rewarded. So the ethic is reciprocal. And I think we have to work hard to communicate that against the ideas of exploitation and profit is evil and all of the negative things about business. That's something we can take on our shoulders, I think. Do you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are no contradictions in the economy, really. There are problems and there are shortcomings, of course, but many of the problems we can really trace back to attempted manipulations of the basic mechanisms in the economy. It really comes down to serving yourself by serving others. And there's no contradiction in that. And by putting your effort into serving others and providing them with the best value possible, you are involved in a process that creates value for both parties.
Yep.
And that's a beautiful system.
Well, let's wrap it up there, Per. We'll try together very hard to see if we can describe this new paradigm and find the right words to use to communicate it. But I, for one, and I think you share the view, I'm very enthusiastic about the beauty and the ethic. And as you say, the lack of contradictions, it's a system that we can embrace. We can help the consumer experience more value and therefore reward more entrepreneurs with more profit. And we look forward to doing that. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me on.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.